Okay, thank you for that introduction. This is really, I've got to be honest, this is really a kind of FAQ idea that sort of occurred to me after we stopped doing FAQs. So on that basis, you can expect one basic idea padded out with a bit of waffle. Just to give some a bit of a background to my thinking here, recently you must have noticed that the word capitalism has been cropping up again in the news. It's always encouraging for us when this happens because it means people are asking the right questions. As we've observed several times during these online talks during this past year, this wasn't always the case. And in fact, people have been known to leave the Socialist Party because they thought that the word capitalism was obsolete and no one knew what it meant anymore. This proved spectacularly to be not the case in the late 90s and early 2000s when the anti-capitalist movement coalesced around the G7 and G8 conferences of the time. And there seemed to be, for a couple of years, that movement seemed to dominate the global headlines. It didn't really have an aim or focus except that it was anti-capitalist, except that even that is arguably overstating the case. I went on one of those demos, huge thing, in Geneva in 2000 or 2001, and there was everyone on this demo. It was absolutely enormous, but there were animal rights activists, trade unions, there were even nuns. But the demos were pretty enormous, and that was impressive by itself. And then, of course, it all inevitably turned rather nasty. There were riots, people got killed, and the whole thing seemed to sort of blow itself out like a passing storm. Now, the next time capitalism appeared on the public agenda was the Occupy movement, which was around 10 years later, probably involved quite a few of the same people. This wave of protests was quite a lot more sedate, and indeed you might say sedentary, than the previous one, because it involved lots of tents in city parks. We had a tent city for a while in my town. Not in the summertime, as you might expect, when I sometimes cynically think people are up for a bit of protesting while getting in a beer and a suntan. But this was in winter, when there was snow on the ground, so full marks to Occupy, our local Occupy, for commitment there. I went to an Occupy rally in our local square right at the start of the campaign, and this very loud and local SWP orator that is known to all the activists in my town popped up out of nowhere and somehow managed to get himself onto the speaker's platform, somewhat to our surprise, where he spoke in thunderous tones about solidarity and ended up with a ringing demand that we should take over the square and we should turn it into Tent City. And we should defy any and every movement to remove us. Well, the crowd went wild and unheated tents sprang up in hours and lasted over a week, crewed by people who looked increasingly cold and miserable as the week progressed. I checked in every couple of days and asked several people I knew, and sure enough, nobody had seen our SWP stalwart since his rallying speech about solidarity. He'd shamelessly gone straight home to his warm house and left all the hard work to other people, as he was famously known to do. Anyway, Occupy also fizzled out in the end because, just like the anti-capitalist movement, it was based on an unsustainable model of protest. People can't keep going on protests. People can't permanently live in tent cities. These are essentially hit-and-run street tactics. And when you find you can't up the ante any longer, and partly because the state won't let you, there's really nowhere for you to go but back out of sight again and thence out of mind. That's why we think the political sphere is the one that activists need to target. Now, Occupy did do one really useful thing and one fairly useless thing. The useless thing, at least from our perspective, was to bang on so much about how rich companies were avoiding paying corporation tax. This was not only a wrong argument, economically speaking, it was the wrong argument, politically speaking, because it implied that capitalism would be all right if only it was a bit more equitable. That's a bit like saying a crocodile would be all right if only it was a bit more vegetarian. Now, the really useful thing Occupy did was to mainstream the idea of the 99% and the 1%. In hindsight, it's easy to forget just what a masterstroke that was. Prior to this, we and other groups had been whittering on for years about income inequality and how the top 5% or so earned more than the bottom 45% or so. There was one worker-run club in Bradford that I went to, which was called the 784 Club, which was based on the same principle. But these figures never really caught the public imagination because nobody agreed exactly on what they were. And of course, they kept changing with time and depending on how you measured them. Now, at the time of the tent cities, I remember some party members sniffily refused to talk in this simplistic language of the 1% and the 99% because it wasn't strictly accurate. But this was the whole point. Politics is about getting people's attention. It doesn't matter how forensically accurate you are if nobody's listening to you. First, get the idea across, then you can argue about the statistics. Now, the key takeaway from this is the phrase capturing the public imagination. I'm hardly being controversial by saying that in the Socialist Party, we've never been very good at doing that. We've been pressing our case for world socialism for over 100 years. And in that time, done a good deal of soul-searching about why we haven't had more success. The times are against us, we say. The word socialism has become too polluted. We're hard to distinguish from the SWP and the Leninist left. People are too distracted by nationalism or reformism or identity politics. Now, personally, I've always thought it was because we lacked marketing nous. We're too hung up on dry theory and factual accuracy to ever coin a ringing phrase or create a viral theme. But now, I think someone is doing it for us, and the word capitalism is creeping back into the headlines, this time from a completely different source. While we're busy ploughing our own lonely furrow, the environmental movement has been gathering strength and pace. The general consensus is that the wellspring of the ecology movement was Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring in 1962. Out of curiosity, I went back to look at the Socialist Standards to see what we said about that book at the time. It wasn't reviewed, or at least I can't find a review of it, not in 1962 or in 63 or at any time in the 1960s. Possibly I'm wrong, but I couldn't find it. In fact, the first reference I could find to ecology or the environment was 10 years later in 1971 with an article called Ecology, the First Decade, looking at the first 10 years of this nascent movement. Now, back then, of course, most of the talk was about industrial pollution, which, of course, is a nasty business caused by private capital trying to maximise profits. But it didn't seem that big a deal to us, I would argue, at the time. It was just one of 100 other nasty issues in capitalism, and probably one that capitalism might very well fix in the fullness of time, with better regulation, bigger fines for polluters, and so on and so forth. And then came climate change, and that was the game changer, because now the future of the entire planet came into question for the first time. And as the extent of the problem became clearer, the rhetoric began to overheat along with the climate. So there was quite a lot of millennial foreboding about total environmental collapse and global extinction. Now, in the interests of dry theory and factual accuracy, I have to say that some of this talk is exaggerated and unhelpful, not to say counterproductive, because it can lead to fatalism. But there, maybe that's me missing the point. Climate change has captured the public imagination in a way that our socialist message never has. People are questioning capitalism now because of what it's doing to the climate, not because of what it's doing to workers. Now, I suppose it's not hard, really, in hindsight, to see why that might be. It's all a matter of perceptions. Class politics is about division. And people don't like harping on division because, in a process of circular logic, they say it's divisive. Class politics tends to be angry politics. and adversarial and worker-based, with its roots historically in industrial unions and large workplaces, all of which now look pretty dated in the post-industrial era of micro-businesses and the gig economy. And all these things have also, I would argue, contributed to class being perceived as male politics, which in turn has become a self-fulfilling prophecy and led to a warring feud between class and other forms of identity, very unfortunately. Class politics is based on Marxist economics, which involves understanding Marxist economics and the complexities of capital, which most people haven't got the time or the inclination to do. And, of course, class politics is perceived as being the road to Stalinist gulags, Maoist uniformity and, genocidal banana republic regimes. I should emphasise, I am talking about perceptions here. I'm not saying that is what class politics is. I'm saying that's how it's perceived. Now, compared to all this sort of angry, largely male-oriented and increasingly ageing adversarial stuff, the environmental movement is warm, inclusive, exciting, modern, and fluffy as bunny rabbits. Its figurehead is a darling teenage girl. It talks about the human race in terms of a unity of common interests, not as a bunch of feuding factions. It hits all the right youth demographics. It incorporates the vital principle of personal and collective responsibility. It's simple to understand without having to do any studying. It's easy to be an activist. All you need to do is recycle. And it's got something that class politics has never had. It's got a ticking clock. Now, because the fact is that humanity has put up with class societies for all of its written history. So it's put up with injustice, inequality, domination by rich elites, virtual slavery for everyone else. It's put up with wars, diseases, famines. It could very easily go on putting up with all those things indefinitely. Inequality is sustainable. Human misery is sustainable. Capitalism is politically sustainable. As socialists, we've been up against something that people found it easier to endure than to change. Maybe it's no wonder we didn't get anywhere. But now some activists are arguing that capitalism is not environmentally sustainable because it's bent on, and in fact built on, infinite growth. And infinite growth, as they point out, is impossible on a finite planet. Capitalism can't stop what it does any more than a crocodile can turn vegetarian, and sooner or later it's going to eat us out of house and home. So now it's a matter of having to change what we can no longer endure. We humans have to stop capitalism before it kills us. And there is the killer argument. There's your ticking clock. It's not saying, like Rosa Luxemburg and others argued, that capitalism will collapse when it runs out of markets. It's saying that capitalism will collapse when it runs out of planet. Now, maybe we should have thought of this argument. Maybe some of us even did. I don't know. It doesn't matter. What matters is that it's a killer argument, and I think it's become a better way into the case for socialism than class politics. Now, a lot of people are currently engaged in synthesising ecology and socialism. There seems to be almost a cottage industry in it. When I say socialism, of course, however they define that, they're calling it eco-socialism. Just today, Howard very kindly sent me a reading list of books he'd just received, which is described as a primer for budding eco-socialists. Loads of interesting looking books on there. I've actually posted that list on Useful Links if anybody wants to have a look at it. But what can we do in practice in the Socialist Party? I'm not suggesting for a minute that we rebrand ourselves somehow as an environmentalist movement. We're obviously not, and with a name like ours, nobody would believe us anyway. But up to now, we've been a class war organisation with a fairly recent and fairly peripheral interest in the environment. This, I would say, needs to change. while we've been standing still, the world has been moving past us. Apart from the pandemic, climate change is probably the biggest global news story out there. So we need our writers and our activists to be focused on this and on the environmentalist movement generally. Here's a few things I think that we could be doing. We could explain why, for all her charismatic charm, Greta Thunberg is never going to get the business leaders of Davos to listen to anything she says. And the sooner she stops bothering with those useless bastards, the better. We could point out that governments in general are useless if what's wanted is real action. Just yesterday, I discovered that we're proceeding 10 times too slowly to hit the Paris Agreement targets. So governments agree to targets and then do nothing about them. The targets are 45% reduction in the next 9 years. So far, they've managed 1%. That's what they're on target for. What else could we do? I think we should show why Extinction Rebellion are repeating the same mistake as Occupy and the anti-capitalist movements by locating their activity principally in the hit-and-run tactics of street theatre instead of in the political arena. I think we should explain why the Green Party's think globally, act locally axiom is politically naive and a blind alley for activists. I think we should show how individual responsibility is important, but collective action is vital. And I think we should make clear why climate activism will never succeed while it clings to its illusions about who has the real power in society, and why the class war between the 1% and the 99% will not go away just because we all want to be fluffy and not think about it. What we can also do is anticipate the capitalist reaction to this debate. Now, just last month, the BBC had a podcast debate called Is Capitalism Destroying Us? There were no big surprises in the arguments, but it was a useful rehearsal of the main points, pro and con. The defenders of capitalism say it can fix the very problems it created. We need to show why that's unlikely. They say it didn't create these problems in the first place. Humans did. We need to show why that's untrue and dishonest. They might try to claim that capitalism can mean sustainable growth. We need to demonstrate why that can't work in language that's easy to understand. Now, some of this, of course, we already try to do sometimes. I'm suggesting that we focus more completely on this, especially this year in the run-up to November's COP26 meeting in Glasgow, which a lot of activists are already saying is going to amount to nothing but greenwashing. Now, it might be ironic that the best argument against capitalism didn't come from anti-capitalists or class war Marxists, but that doesn't make what we say irrelevant. It makes it more important than ever. Environmentalists may succeed in putting capitalism on trial, but the danger is they'll be baffled and bamboozled by clever defence lawyers arguing for palliative reforms and a gradualist approach. Socialists need to be in the courtroom, ready to cut those arguments off at the knees, as witnesses for the prosecution. Because if we don't, there's always the chance that capitalism will get off on a technicality. And we don't have time for that. The clock is ticking, and we have a lot of work to do. Okay, thank you.